Welcome back to the Tour Daily, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. Someone has to set the scene, except currently everybody who we've invited onto this podcast is looking up Victor Lefay.
Just trying to figure out.
Victor Lefay is the scene.
He is the scene. He's a name with which nominative determinism could work well for him. This morning, Ian and myself were in the Start Village and we watched Omar Fraley's son drop a cone of chips or fries.
And Omar Fraley's mum, who was watching the son, picked up all the chips, and there was a moment of tension where we were like, is Grandma Fraley going to give Fraley Jr. floor chips? But then she put them in the bin, so.
Yeah, so that was the other nominative determinism of the day, that maybe the constitution of the Fraleys lives up to the name, so no floor chips. But anyway, Victor Lefay, what a... He's...
Really the story of the day.
Today. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't think of a bigger storyline.
I thought your story of the day would have been Thibaut Pinot coming in fourth.
I was genuinely impressed by it. You didn't see that? He was cruising for it. It was good. Yeah. We should actually set the scene. We are in Bilbao because the first stage of the Tour de France, which is what just wrapped up not too long ago, it started in Bilbao and it went out and did a bunch of hills. And it came back to Bilbao. And in fact, we were about a 15-minute walk away from our lovely Airbnb. It was a pretty fantastic finish. We had two brothers duking it out into the finale. We also had two different, quite different versions of events about that. Whether there were any gifts that happened today. We heard some different things from, depending on which brother, which twin you talk to. And then behind, we had not really sort of a GC fight, but we had quite obviously the two best bike riders in the race showing us they were the two best bike riders in the race. And then also Victor Lefay being exceptional.
On the Bilbao thing, I just want to fact check a headline on a newspaper that I saw when we were walking up to the stage finish, which described the stage as Bilbao to Bilbao, true, a stage with passion. True or false? Was there passion?
Yeah, there was absolutely passion. I saw a lot of passion out there today.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was passion from Tadej Pogacar.
Yep.
When he crossed the line in third.
Yep.
There was a tantalizing hint of a suggestion that maybe he didn't understand that he was crossing the line in third, but then we realized that he was actually pleased for his teammate.
Yep.
I think Pogacar, besides Victor Lefay, is probably, for me, the story of the day, because it's very clear that, or it seemed very clear to me from today, that he is doing pretty well and should not be worried too much about his wrist, from what we've seen.
Counterpoint. I would have expected the Tadej Pogacar that we generally know to not really sit up over the top of that climb like he did today.
Maybe he's learned from last year. Maybe he's not looking to burn every match over a climb 7K out from the finish where, you know, Victor Lefay is still in contact.
I thought it was more interesting. Vinigo is already writing like he has a jersey to defend, or, you know, I don't want to use the cliche, so I'll only say half it, but you're not going to win the Tour today. And it was almost as if Vinigo was like, well, I'm not riding through. I'm going to follow you if you're going to do something. But
that's a euro in the bucket. I'm sorry.
What other way can I say that?
Well, and now Pogacar has 4 seconds, 4 bonus seconds on Vingegaard. So they ride together every day until the end of the Tour. There is a time trial, of course, but... Pogacar's in the driving seat early. Can we say that? Are we doing a sort of ESPN wake up, good morning football thing?
I don't think we can say that. No, but I guess like I was kind of expecting, and the way that this stage was kind of played up is that it was a potential GC stage, and I don't think we really saw that. Like, we saw the two best GC riders separate themselves from everybody except for Victor Lefay, and then look at each other. And it kind of shut it back down. You saw him come over the top. And granted, I think I mentioned this in the podcast yesterday. When I rode it, it was a headwind as soon as he made that right-hand turn. I'm going to guess it was the same today because it's the wind's off the water like it usually is. So they made that right-hand turn, headwind. They realize they're not going to really gain or lose significant time, and they kind of shut it down, right? And that's why we ended up with the Yates on Yates action up front.
Yeah, I don't think it was going to be a GC day. I think it was going to be a day when the GC riders were in the front. And that's the two Yates brothers, they are GC riders. Behind that was Pogacar, all the favorites in a small group. And I think it was the finale was always going to be hard enough that it was going to be those riders in the front, but we weren't going to see huge gaps. And that, you know, if we chat about fantasy league for a second, that was kind of why I went for Mike Woods, because I wanted which GC rider isn't going to lose time in the finale today, but I would be willing to sacrifice for later in the race. And he was a rider who was unlikely to, you know, you could. I wonder, did anybody pick Victor Lefay? Did anybody in any fantasy competition anywhere on the planet pick Victor Lefay for today? Because I'm sure they were.
My fun stat about Victor Lefay, I was just looking at his pro cycling stats page, and I noticed that he has had a big spike in people looking at him on pro cycling stats. 16,000 more visits this week compared to last week. So,
and probably all in the last half hour.
The name on everyone's lips, Lefay.
Tell me more about Victor Lefay. And I should say, for anybody who wasn't paying really close attention to the finale today, this is the only rider, the Cofidis rider, who was just riding alongside Tadej Pogacar and Jonas Vingegaard up the steepest climb of the Tour de France thus far.
He's won a stage of the Giro a couple of seasons ago, so he's not a...
He's a good bike rider.
Yeah.
He's been with Cofidis since 2017. Won a stage of the Arctic Race of Norway last year. Another big race. Big win.
Yep.
And that's it.
Lives in Annecy.
But, I mean, that's the kind of performance that you from Cofidis that you only see in Cofidis commercials.
No, come on. Guillaume Martin finishes 10th sometimes.
No. Guillaume Martin today would have attacked on the fourth last climb, even though there was only two climbs in the finale. And been caught at the bottom of the second last climb. So I'd say Victor Lefay did a much, much better job than Martin would have done.
Well, he spends less of his time sort of mulling philosophy than Guillaume Martin.
And tending his donkeys.
Yep.
It's just owning an Airbnb with donkeys.
It's just occurred to me that I didn't introduce anybody today.
It just occurred to me also, yeah.
Yep. So we're going to do that. I did introduce myself, so I'm going to skip myself. To my left here, Ronan McLaughlin, how are you?
I'm good. Nice of you to ask.
Ian Treller, how's the jet lag?
Yeah, good. I had a 15-minute power nap.
That's good.
At about 60K to go. Mm. We were watching in the I almost called it a hotel, but that is a
you called
disservice
it the hotel
to hotels.
To me earlier, like, we're going back to the hotel. I just looked at you like, it's not a hotel.
It's barely an Airbnb.
What does it say on your eye mask, Ian?
It has one bowl.
What does it say on my eye mask? Yeah. Thank you. I'll field this one. So my eldest daughter bought an eye mask for me before the tour last year, and at that time she couldn't read because she was a young child. She just liked the sparkly gold. So I've got a sparkly gold eye mask that says Bon Voyage Bitches on it. Which is a good thing to whip out on flights, and an even better thing to wear when you're just sleeping in a room in Bilbao. And Johnny walks in to wake me up to say it's time to go.
That's fantastic. And Johnny Long, how are you?
Good. Good stage. The Brits are winning.
The Brits are winning.
The Brits are winning.
Both of them.
All of them.
All of them. Yeah. And you just heard briefly there, Josh, you're kind of working on a story right now, so you're not going to be heavily involved in this podcast, but you are here.
Yeah, but I'm happy to be included.
Happy to be included. Have a beer in front of you. Pleased. Okay,
can we talk about the differing Yates's stance on how they arrived at this conclusion of the stage?
Yeah, let's. Okay, so I should say that we basically assume when you're listening to this podcast that you have watched at least some of the race or have read a story about how it unfolded or something like that.
No spoilers.
We're not going to give you the like play by play of the. Of the bicycle race. But, obviously, in broad strokes, we end up with both Yates's, Adam and Simon Yates, off the front. Obviously, one of those is on UAE. The other is on Jayco Alula. They're off the front together. this is interesting because they are twins. And they have actually, and I got this confirmed with Matt White, who has probably known these two longer than almost anybody else in the professional sport, that they have never raced against each other in that way at a Grand Tour, ever. They've never found themselves in that position, ever. And I think that's pretty fascinating. It made for a very interesting end to a stage, which, let's be honest, the Yateses don't always inspire rabid fandom, I think, from this particular group. And so if it was just one of them off the front, we'd be like, okay, yeah, cool. Excellent, excellent day. Having both of them off the front made it really quite interesting.
It's sort of like in the US office when Dwight Schrute hurriedly gestures Michael Scott to come and join him because he's looking at something. Michael come here, and he's like, and it's two short fellas in suits. And he's like, twins, magnificent, aren't they? And that's sort of the vibe that the Yates brothers gave off today. It was like, especially when they look for the first pull to come through, I was like, this could either it's going to be great because it's like two brothers working together and it's, you know, it's more I'm the son of a Belgian farmer vibe, or it's brothers not pulling.
I briefly toyed with asking one of them, like just going up to them and asking if they ever get confused about which one they are. But then I thought the better of it.
That's like the level of question that you're at a party with a bunch of people you don't know, but there's like someone there who's like outed themselves as a twin and you're trying to make small talk by asking them every twin question that they've heard before.
Well, honestly, when we were watching it, we were like, are they speaking to each other? Are they just doing this by osmosis? Do they know? Do they know what the other is going to do?
Yeah, I would. That's what I would assume.
Did you know that Adam Beckett's a twin?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And I asked him who would win in the same situation if it was him and his twin, and he said that his sister is deeply unathletic and that he would definitely win. So if she would like to come on and correct the record, let us know.
I mean, what I'll say is that today really dealt a crushing blow to my theory that there's only one Yates.
Let's talk about...
The question I was just Googling was, can twins feel each other's pain?
I think that's probably the deepest, most philosophical thing you've ever Googled. Usually it's like...
My Google is full of interesting history.
And particularly interesting if the answer is yes, because that was a lot of pain in
there,
that case.
Yes, there are twins who say they have felt each other's pain, and their close relationship and nearly identical physical structure means there could be a sliver of truth in this theory. As pain can be psychologically and can...
Is this in a medical journal?
This is not. This is on... You should know this. It's on abc.net.au.
Ah.
Yeah, you've read the whole anthology. How much pain do you reckon... if Adam Yates can feel Simon Yates' pain, how much pain do you think he felt in the finale? Did Simon Yates cramp, or was it a gifted victory? Because Adam Yates has won a lot less than...
I mean, we need the UCI to test for this, because if it worked one way and didn't work the other way, that's an extremely unfair advantage.
But Simon has not worn a yellow jersey.
That's true. Do you think it was they know each other well enough that Simon knew that Adam would have just beaten him anyway? So it's like, why waste the energy and the mental spirit to just get trounced by my twin brother?
I think that sort of physiologically, and this is not going to surprise anybody, they're quite similar. And in fact, that's what Matt White said when Lionel Burney and I were talking to him. Their numbers are similar. Their physiology is similar. I think that they probably have raced each other enough that they probably both had some idea who was going to win that. But it's more, I think they're close enough. It's basically like, who did more pulling ahead of time? Who was pulling, you know, down the descent more than the other? The interesting thing here was that we got two kind of different stories depending on which team and which Yates we were talking to. So you went over, Johnny, and you were talking to UAE, which would have been the Adam side. And I was over at Jayco talking to the Simon side. And what did you hear?
Machin, that's how you pronounce it, right? The general manager. Yeah, he was very happy to have the yellow jersey in sort of his home region. But he was saying that he let the riders on the road sort of let it develop. And that once Adam had gone off the front, that was decided between them. And I need to listen back, and we'll have an article about this, but I think it was... They were saying that they knew it was a better finish for Adam than it was Simon. So then they were like, well, you're going to win the stage in the yellow, so of course, go for it.
So to add to that, Simon said that he could hear his brother on the radio, so Adam, UAE Adam. This is going to confuse anybody who's not really clear on which brother's on which team. UAE Adam was on the radio to his director saying, can I pull? Right? Because the other thing that he was potentially doing there is pulling a competitor, Simon, away from his team leader, Tadej Pogacar. Right? So he did apparently get the approval to pull, but if you go watch that back, Adam definitely skipped a couple pulls kind of early on, and that was basically why. He was waiting for the green light to go for it.
To be fair, though, it was Adam that caused the split on the final climb there. And actually, when he made that split and Pogacar, Vinigo, and Lefay came through, Adam was in difficulty there. He didn't, you know, he wasn't with those three riders going over the top, as far as I remember. And a gap opened there, and he couldn't close it. And then he came back with all the riders to the front again. And there's obviously a bit of a lull or something. They made a move, and the two brothers got away together. So,
well, Simon bridged across to him.
Hmm.
Yeah. So we end up with a situation where UAE is kind of saying, like, they figured it out on the road. It was the implication there that it was not predetermined, but that it was, you know, two brothers working it out, right?
Well, and this, you know, maybe this is more mind games, but if anything, what we've heard Adam talk on the radio, that sort of disproves the mind game theory that Yates and Pogacar are co-leaders. Because why would you ask if you can pull if you're a co-leader?
This is
and
very
you're
true.
Off the front of the race.
And,
so.
And if you're a co-leader, why would you cause a split in the final climb and get yourself dropped? You wouldn't.
There's just so much lying in the sport.
There's a lot of lying.
I'm not sure
we all
lying.
Just tell the truth.
I guess strategically using the truth, bending the truth.
And do you know who's going to be really upset about this? Wout van Aert, because he was not happy with the mind games in the pre-race press conference. So he's just going to be furious.
Be furious with all the lying. Yeah. So the other people that I talked to over at Jayco, I was talking to Brent Copeland, and then I was also talking to, Simon Yates himself and Matt White. At first, when I was standing with Copeland and Yates hadn't shown up yet, he had the same take I had, which just watching it, it looked like a gift, right? Initially, I'm like, Simon didn't look like he was sort of fully gassed when that gap opened up. His, you know, he wasn't sort of face on his stem on the rivet, so to speak. He looked like it kind of, you know, he's like, I don't want to hurt anymore. You go for it. This is fine. Then as soon as I started talking to Simon Yates, he sounded kind of a little bit perturbed that he wasn't wearing a yellow jersey. And then Matt White kind of confirmed the same thing, which was that, you know, these two don't do gifts like that. They kind of have something of an agreement where when they're bike racing. And, you know, I'm sure that there was slightly smoother pulls taken than might have been otherwise, considering it was two brothers. But I think in the end, anyway, Matt White was convinced that it was just a bike race at the end.
I also think, in terms of looking at the team, at stage one on day one and taking the yellow jersey would have made Jayco's tour. And I don't think Simon would have been, if he did give that away, I think he would have been quite a bit of trouble tonight.
Yep,
if that ever came out.
I agree.
Whereas for UAE, you know, they're hoping to get multiple stage ones and the yellow in Paris with Pog. So I don't buy the idea that it was a gift.
Yeah, the other thing that White said was, you know, Simon hasn't worn a yellow jersey, so we were kind of hoping that the gift would go the other direction, right? Mm. And obviously it didn't. So I think they just raced it. Like I said, my initial impression after watching it was that there was a gift that happened. But after speaking with the people involved and sort of seeing their reaction to the things that had happened, I think it was just Simon had some cramps. I think he probably did. Maybe he pulls up a little bit earlier than he would have otherwise, but I don't think he was going to win that stage today.
If only the bonus points were left at the top of the Côte de Piquet, because then you could have one brother stage win, one brother yellow jersey, and then that would have been even better.
Alas. We would have to do that math quite quickly, though. Yeah. Well, so there you go. We, a bit of drama between the twins. I a good way for the Tour de France to start, I think, this year.
Would love to have been a fly in the wall in the Yates' parents' house.
Yeah.
Do you think they have a favorite child?
I mean, that would have been, the fly would know.
It's so cruel.
If so, which one?
that little shit stole his brother's yellow jersey.
So Ronan's on Team Simon.
I think I am, yeah. Yeah. I think I would have been a Simon fan, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take a quick break.
Oh, hi. Were you enjoying this podcast before I so rudely interrupted it? Okay, I won't keep you long. Our podcasts, like all of our content at The Escape Collective, are member funded. If you're already a member, then thank you. And if you're not, then please consider supporting what we do. For more information, visit escapecollective.com/join. Your support helps us to continue creating unique, authentic, and trustworthy content from many facets of cycling. It also gains you access into the community side of Escape Collective, which includes a vibrant Discord group where you'll also find the occasional live recording of our podcasts. Monthly memberships are $11.99 USD, or you can save 30% by signing up annually. Visit escapecollective.com/join to sign up. Okay, back to the show.
And we're back. And we have new drinks. Who can explain to me what we are drinking?
I think Johnny's the obvious person, seeing as I've just had one for the first time today.
It's called Calimucho. It was introduced to me last summer. It's a drink popular, as we've seen around Bilbao, with a lot of the youth. It's sort of a more, culturally, I think, it's a more refined version of having like a vodka Red Bull. But what it is, in fact, is red wine and Coca-Cola mixed together.
That people doesn't
listening,
sound good.
Yeah, people listening will be like, that sounds disgusting.
I thought agreed. That as well.
I agree when I first heard of
I'm
it.
I'm about then, to have it for the first time.
Okay, here we go. Let's have your reaction.
Doesn't sound disgusting to me.
Kaylee's sipping. He's thinking.
That's quite good.
It's good, isn't it? It's refreshing.
That's annoyingly good. Yeah.
It doesn't sound disgusting to me. It just sounds like the worst thing you could possibly drink. Rat poison or something is the next step.
I think it's good. I do question whether the bartender took advantage of the fact that I don't speak much. Any Spanish. Does this round of drinks seem like a €29 round of drinks?
Oh, yes.
I think you paid for both rounds.
Oh, yeah. He did ask all.
Thank
and
you.
I said, oh.
Thank you for buying two rounds of drinks, Ian.
So I paid for all.
There you go.
That's you sorted for about a week and a half.
Great.
But yes. Yes, that's what Calimucho is. It's delicious. It's refreshing. Wherever you are in the world, everyone can buy red wine and Coca-Cola. Maybe pause this podcast right now. Pour yourself in equal parts of Calimucho.
Is it equal parts red wine and Coke?
That's how I make it at home. This is more delicious than what I have
It doesn't look like equal parts.
No,
that's wine.
It's probably one third wine and then a full 375ml bottle of Coke per serving.
The bartender here had a very interesting technique to mix the drinks. He poured the wine first, and then he rotates the glass of wine as he's pouring the Coca-Cola in. But he's pouring the Coca-Cola in the center, so there's no real mixing going on. Whether he's rotating the
glass
or not.
What he's aiming for? No, he could be aiming for like a whirlpool effect.
Oh.
And if he spins it fast enough, then there could be some sort of centrifugal force. And a really well-spun Calimuchos could just fly out of the glass all over the bar, coating everybody in a mix of red wine, one third, and Coca-Cola, two thirds.
Or it will curdle. It will curdle the wine.
Well, there you go. There's your bit of actually, we're going to have more culture from Jose Bain later in the episode that's probably slightly better researched, but we are...
And more cultured.
And more cultured, but it's what we're having this evening. We also never really set the scene, so someone just briefly, so that our listeners can picture where we are.
I can do it in one line.
Okay.
It's like a warm Ostend. In Belgium, if anybody's ever been to Ostend.
I don't think that helps most of our audience.
Okay. It's like a
bit rough.
Apartment towers.
A bit rough.
Yeah.
A little bit rough.
Two piles of rubble behind us.
Urban, yeah.
No, but no beats inside.
Yeah, we're in the middle of some apartment towers, sort of stuck up on a hill above the old town, which is where our Airbnb is.
But nice bars.
But lovely bar and lovely people having a great time and kids running around and kid playing soccer over here and football. And
it's a very chilled out town.
Very chilled out town.
If you're at a laptop right now, Google Maps and Street View the Haro Plaza.
Haro Plaza.
H-A-R-O Plaza.
And then imagine us sitting at it with a bunch of Calamuchos.
We are at the Cafe Otso.
Otso. O-T-S-O. There you go. You can Google it yourself.
And we're across the road from a place that, I mean, in Bilbao, the Basque call it Bilbo. So you just, if you're a Lord of the Rings head, you're just looking around and it's Bilbo everywhere. There's Bilbo everywhere. Buses. It's lots of Bilbo, which is good. So we are across from a place that I don't know what they sell, but it's called Bilbo Gestion.
That means management.
Bilbo management. Gandalf over there.
I'm moving us on. Okay, we have a couple of things to talk about today. Actually, this one was on our list for yesterday, but we never got to it. We want to talk radios and team cars. So first and foremost, I'm interested to hear from our listeners out there. You can hit us on Discord if you are a member, and you should be. You can tweet at us, at Escape Collective, at Kaylee Fretz. You can find us on the internet. I want to know what you all think of the radios that were in the broadcast today. Now, from what I saw, it was pretty basic radio so far. I think we're going to get some better stuff later on. But I guess the reason why the topic was interesting to me is actually a little bit of sort of background politics behind it. So, according to reports, each of the teams involved, and it's 17 of the 22, agreed to have their team radio transmissions maybe show up and broadcast. Now, it is all these radio transmissions, they're all sort of going into somebody who's listening to them all, and they're picking out the good ones. They're also not just posting stuff that might embarrass people. Like, there's some sort of checks and balances here. But for their trouble, for releasing their internal communications, tactical communications to the entire world, they get $5,000. And that feels
princely
just,
sum.
I just, like, why even bother, I guess, is really my thing with it.
Do you think it's because there was an article in West France the other day where teams are complaining about how they're coming, some of them are coming to the tour now and they're ending the tour like €50,000 in the red because of increased costs. Every day you're only given the budget for 24 rooms paid for, but obviously teams bring a lot more, so that is up to them, but then you're trying to compete with everyone, so I guess you factor that in. So maybe this is a way of ASO, instead of imposing it as a rule, like, you have to do this, it's a way to sweeten the deal a bit and not make it feel like it's all take. Even if it's an insignificant sum, it probably, £5,000 is better than a smack in the face.
What's something else? UAE budget about 40 million?
Yeah, but for those teams, you just do it for everyone, don't you? The small, I'm thinking the smaller French teams who are more.
Arkea probably cares more than Ineos.
Yeah, because it's about 0.001 of Ineos's budget. The five
but
grand.
Arkea are charging children on the roadside when they throw a bottle to them.
Just go hat in hand.
€2, please.
I mean, but I think it's kind of interesting because it's like another step in the F1-ification of cycling, you know. And this one is unlike the extremely clumsy grid start we had a few years ago.
That was wild.
Yeah.
And by wild, I mean boring.
And served no purpose. It's not like there was qualifying. You know, unlike that, it's like this is something that does improve the viewer's experience. I mean, unless you think it doesn't.
No, I think it does.
I'm interested to see how it goes. We've only seen one or two radio broadcasts today because we didn't really catch much of the races. We're
out and about.
Taking
naps.
Some of us were corresponding to BBC also, so, you know.
BBC 4.
Sure. Also sounds like BBC Radio 4.
Yeah, BBC 4.
BBC 4. Ford. Anyway, the worrying part for me is that this was somewhat optional for the teams. I think it should have just been the ASO say, well, you want to do the Tour de France, you will broadcast your radio, and we don't have to pay you anything for it, because try having a sponsor without doing the Tour de France.
This is the thing that, for me, was a little bit, like, what's the point? The 5K became sort of a headline, and Twitter was talking about it, and everyone's like, ah, that's unfair. But, like, if you come at it from ASO's perspective, like, that was basically just a little gift. That was a little like, we'll just give you something because we can. Because fundamentally, none of the teams, like the AIG GCP, which is the big sort of team organization, only has some of the teams in it. They can't operate as a unit. They can't sort of like unionize as teams, basically. And so they're all divided and conquered constantly. And any single one of them can leave the Tour de France, and the Tour de France will be fine. All of the power rests with ASO. They could literally just say, you give us your radio or you don't show up.
Give us 5,000 euro.
They could charge for it. I mean, like, that's what they do to us, right? They charge 700 euros for internet for the month from us because they're basically like, we don't actually care about any single one of you. Pay up. They could do that. And instead, they've given them $5,000, which, again, just sort of accidentally created negative headlines that wouldn't have existed at all.
The only thing is I guess there's a chance that $5,000 is to cover whatever technology is required to broadcast the radio live, because previously it was just going car to rider, rider to car. Now it's also having to get broadcast. So maybe the 5,000 is to cover whatever extra expense they have. I don't know. But the worrying part for me is that because they've been paid to be on it, not all the teams are on it. What quality of radio broadcast are we going to get? Are we just going to get the same thing over again? Remember to eat, remember to drink. Dangerous part coming up. Be at the front. Remember to eat, remember to drink. Or are we actually going to get stuff that is actually interesting? And you know, the stuff we all want to hear is the stuff the teams don't want us to broadcast.
Yep.
So what I want to know is how much say the teams have on what's broadcast.
Well, Cofidis are one of the teams that didn't sign up to it, which is weird anyway, because surely they're looking for any mentions they can get. But that would have been a good one today to hear the team talking to Victor Lefay when he was in that situation. That would have been the perfect
moment. About a perfect example of cycling teams not knowing where their actual value lies is that, right? Like, Cofidis having apparently thinking that this might be a sort of racing disadvantage and not weighing that against extra airtime at the biggest race of the entire year for them. Like, it's whoever's making that decision doesn't actually understand what's valuable about their team, which is still wild to me.
After a decade of or more of not having won a stage at the Tour, it definitely doesn't come down to them being able to communicate on the radio with their riders without anyone else hearing. But maybe that might change this year.
It's actually a missed opportunity as well, because had they broadcast what they're saying to the readers, maybe we could have figured out where they're going wrong.
Yeah.
That's true. That's very true.
I'm just waiting for UAE and Pogacar to realise that they can just start telling Pogacar, like, right, 5K, you're going to attack, and then just see the stern-faced Jumbo boys just absolutely losing their minds. And then just by the end of it, they're just weepy messes on the floor, just shell-shocked because they expect an attack.
I mean, in F1, you get some, like, coded...
Yes, you get subterfuge.
You get coded radio messages, right, Josh?
Yeah, it's used tactically all the time because they know that the broadcast... That the communications are broadcast. So if you can, you know, maybe just let your opponents think that you're preparing, a tire change or, a different pit stop strategy... Well, you're not going to, correct them over the radio.
I should say I asked Josh because you're working on an F1 book at the
moment.
That's
correct.
14 hours a day writing nonstop.
Due out next spring. Before the Formula 1 season, the next season of Drive to Survive.
If you have caught any of Josh's previous books, The Club is my personal favorite. You'll know this one is going to be good.
Same idea.
I want to ask Josh, who do you think would be the Kimi Raikkonen of the Tour de France peloton? As in the guy who just says, leave me alone, I know what I'm doing.
I mean, like, that would have been prime Sagan.
That would have been.
Like, back in the day, he would have just been like, leave me alone, I'm going to attack now, 50K from the finish at Paris-Roubaix.
I feel like Pogacar is a little bit like that.
I think Pogacar would be more having fun.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Kimi was like, just leave me alone.
I don't want to talk to people.
Yeah.
I'm driving.
Well, have an art. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good shout. That's a good one.
That's good.
I'm more looking forward to when, wasn't it with Ferrari, how they've had to stop saying like plan A, plan B, because they would get so far through the alphabet they'd become embarrassing. So they just change up how they do it so that to try and save face.
Yeah, I believe that's now called Plan EF.
Oh! You're going to get a talking to from Jonathan Vodders tomorrow. All right, let's wrap up that radio chat. We just thought it was interesting. I thought it was silly that they gave him $5,000. I think it's silly that frankly, I think it's silly that ASO even bothered. Because if I was them, I would just say, nope. Congratulations, you are in the Tour de France, and therefore we have your radio. That's how this works. Because, like I said, all of the power is in their hands, for better and for worse. Another little tidbit from this morning. I just wanted to mention this, because, frankly, I don't think we're going to write a full story on it, but you heard it here first, podcast listeners. We were chatting with the sort of liaison between Trek and the Trek, well, formerly Trek Segafredo team, now Little Trek. And got a little insight into that deal. And I think it's interesting, particularly for anybody out there who is a Trek fan, because from what we now know, this deal increases their budget quite significantly. It's going to basically, Segafredo was, I think, pretty happy to get a 6-month discount, basically. And they've had some trouble through the pandemic and cafes closing and things like that. So they're gone completely. And Little steps in, and Little is one of the biggest grocery chains on the planet, and they're bringing somewhere like 2 to 4x the amount of money that Segafredo was bringing before. Trek is still going to put the same amount of money in next year. So basically this team, according to the fellow we were talking to, goes from kind of a bottom third in terms of budget to top third, which is a huge, huge swing and really changes the way that Trek, I think, will operate within the sort of rider market and what this team looks like for next year. So, like I said, if you're a fan of this team, exciting things coming up thanks to the new Little sponsorship, which I think a lot of us just assumed would be kind of a direct swap for Segafredo, but it's a step up, basically.
Not so little.
Not so little.
Quite big, X.
Thank you, Ronan. Couple other talking points from today. We had a couple over at EF, some good stuff, some bad stuff. What was it?
Yep. Well, Carapaz crashed alongside Enric Mas. He's Spanish, not French. Mas has crashed out of the Tour, which is bad news for Movistar. It looked quite innocuous, like on the descent. It was one of those crashes where nothing else is happening, and then suddenly
touch wheels and
yeah. So the quote from the EFDS about Carapaz, who finished the race but came across the line like 10 minutes down, bleeding from his knee, looked in pretty bad shape. The DS said he did a fair bit of damage to his knee. At first, he wasn't sure if he could move it because it really hurt, but we managed to encourage him to get back on the bike in case there wasn't a fracture and he could continue. The docs are checking him out right now, and we'll see how the injuries are. Doesn't sound like it's going to be good, and that Carapaz and any sort of juicy hopes are done, if not his race. That was the bad day for EF. The good day was that Nielsen Paulus hit out on the sole Category 2 climb of the day. Got 5 points, and so is in the King of the Mountains jersey, and that was a plan from the start of the day to get a jersey, sort of like we saw last year with Magnus Cort. And I guess if you get that jersey early, get a trip to the podium, sort of as an early box ticked in terms of Tour success, and probably settles the nerves of everyone, especially because as we saw from the Netflix documentary, if they don't win, then everyone's fired and out of jobs.
But that's the only team where that's true.
Yep.
Well, good for them. Good for Palace.
Good for the sponsor.
Which is also the team owner. Yeah. No, it's we like to keep an eye on EF. Real bummer for Carapaz. I think that's that removes a lot of their options throughout the next 3 weeks. But Palace was also has been really impressive for the last couple of years, and he'll do some special things, I think, this tour.
The other thing from today is, in terms of access, it feels like no tour that I've been at. I started coming after the pandemic. And there is like proper scrums now outside the team buses and at EF. Maybe there's massive Colombian population in Bilbao or Spain, but everyone who's Colombian and lives in Spain was outside the EF bus, and you had to sort of push past them to try and get to interview the riders and the DSs. And they were chanting Rigo so loudly for so long. And you saw the look on some of the EF staff members' faces of like, this is cool, but also if this is what it's going to be like sort of every day or like even just tomorrow, then this is going to be a long tour. You couldn't hear yourself think. It was crazy. But also great to see, because you didn't, before the fans had been kept away, the riders liked it as well. All the EF riders were coming back in and sort of waving. It was great.
It does worry me a little bit, because we as journalists are encouraged, heavily encouraged, forced? I don't know. We have to wear masks when we are around riders. Yeah. But we are as far away from the riders as the general public, especially today. So I do have some concerns about the safety of the race and the integrity of the race when everyone is just in such close proximity and allowed to have that kind of access.
We wouldn't have to have masks on if Remco Evenepoel hadn't left the Giro with COVID. Like that's basically that's what it comes down to. So yeah, I mean it feels pretty performative because I'm standing there with a mask on asking questions and fella to my right is standing there without a mask on screaming his lungs out at the same rider. Like it feels a bit silly, but I think it'll probably start to kind of relax when we get into the second and third week. Like every rest day we get past where they do testing, they'll relax probably a little bit. The teams will relax a bit.
Does rest day testing happen this year?
Well, so only internally and only if they want to. That's the thing. Is and even if they test positive, they don't have to leave. It's just
or tell anyone
or tell anybody. It's literally just. I mean, if you think back to the Giro, remember we found out that Remco Evenepoel had COVID. I think if you looked at him after that time trial, you would have been like, he's got something. I don't know what he's got, but he's got something. At this point, it's not that they're worried about testing positive for COVID. It's that they're worried about riders getting too sick to continue. And that's always been a problem at the Tour de France. I mean, you're talking about 200 riders in close proximity to lots of fans who are riding themselves into the ground to the point where their immune systems are not particularly up to snuff by week two or so. Like, they always get sick. I have had so many conversations with riders second week of a Tour de France where they've been sick already for a week and they're just trudging through. And I think that's basically what they're trying to minimize. It's again, it feels a bit. I don't know. I don't really care. Like, I'll wear a mask and chat with Simon Yates. I just don't. Doesn't bother me in any way. It just feels like I'm not actually helping, really, because there's 1,000 people all around me not doing that.
It might not be helping, but I'm also happy to wear a mask when you consider what these writers and team support staff and all are giving up with. You know, we all talk about the riders going to altitude camps, but they have support staff there with them as well, and everybody is away from their families, away from home for weeks on end to prepare for the race where they're going to be a week away from home for weeks on end. So,
no, 100%. Yeah. It's not exactly an onerous thing. Like, it's not difficult. Just chuck it on your face. It just feels useless, basically, is my problem. But we will continue. We will continue. And hopefully, fingers crossed, nobody gets COVID and nobody gets kicked out. Or not kicked out, because no one's going to get kicked out. No one has to leave the race over the next couple of weeks. Well, I think let's cut it off there. In terms of on-the-ground chatter here, I'm going to throw you over to Jose Bain to discuss a bit of culture from tomorrow's stage.
I started with the history of the Basque language, but I should have started with the history of the Basque country. It is rich and complex, dating back thousands of years, but I will be brief and far from complete because I do not have 15 minutes on this podcast. I already told you that some linguists think the Basque language has roots in the languages spoken by cave dwellers in the Stone Age. Well, we know that people lived here by the paintings they left in caves, in, for example, Santi Ma Minye, on the left bank of the river Urdubai, where we have an intermediate sprint on stage two. Santi Ma Minye's cave paintings were discovered in 1916 as, out of curiosity, some boys ran into the caves. The paintings depict several animals such as horses, goats and deer. They are closed to the general public, but there are guided tours. Onwards. During the Roman age, the Basque territories were part of Hispania Tarraconensis, but they maintained a level of independence we see again and again throughout the history. After the Romans came the Visigoths and then the Moors, the Arab peoples, but the Basques resisted and kept their own cultural identity. We're talking Middle Ages. Later in the Middle Ages, when Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon married in the 15th century, they unified the Spanish regions under their rule. The Spanish crown recognized the Basque legal institutions and customs, leading to the establishment of the Basque fueros, a set of regional laws. In the early modern period, the Basque Country experienced relative autonomy within the Kingdom of Spain. However, during the Napoleonic Wars in the early 19th century, the Basque territories were occupied by French forces and the region's autonomy was diminished. Then in the 19th and 20th centuries, the Basque Country witnessed significant industrialization, especially in the Spanish part. The region became a center of mining, steel production, and shipbuilding, contributing to its economic growth. The Basque National Movement emerged in the late 19th century, advocating for greater autonomy or independence for the Basque Country. The movement experienced periods of repression under the Franco dictatorship, which lasted from 1939 to 1975. And as I taught you yesterday, Franco aimed to suppress regional identities and languages, including Basque. After Franco's death, Spain transitioned to a democratic system, and the Basque Country, along with other regions like, for example, Catalonia, gained a significant degree of self-government. The Basque Statute of Autonomy was established in 1979, granting the region a broad range of powers, including control over education, culture, and taxation. The government of the Basque Country is in Vitoria, or Gasteiz in Basque. It's the city we start the second stage, and it's led by the president of the Autonomous Government of the Basque Country, or Lehendakari. There are three provinces in Spain: Álava, where Gasteiz is, Biscaya, where Bilbao is, and Gipuzkoa, where our Finnish town of San Sebastian or Donostia is. There's so much more to say about the history of this cycling-loving part of Spain, and it's so much bigger and more colourful than I just described. I would advise you to read one of the many interesting books and wonderful literature produced in the Basque language, but I won't ask you to read it in Basque, but there are many books translated. Enjoy.
Thank you to Jose. I've been loving these. And a reminder, if you sort of pick up on some of the additional details there that you might have missed in podcast form, these are online every day at escapecollective.com. Head on over. Last, but certainly not least, the Giro is also on right now, and our own Abby Mickey is going to give us a bit of an update on what's going on down in Italy.
Well, I got the stage wrong. I was like, oh yeah, sprint. But that's because looking at the profile, the climb didn't really look super significant. But the Giro Donna is going to Giro Donna, and I really should have known.
Yeah. I mean, a climb is a climb. When Van Vleuten sees a profile like that, I think she just sees that that's an opportunity for her. And it also means she probably wants the pink jersey from stage one and wants to keep it the whole way through to the finish. So, yeah, but I just looked and the climb was really twisty, and also the descent was quite twisty as well. So, yeah, looks like an exciting one out there.
We don't actually know like exactly how things went down because the live coverage crapped out on the final climb with about 20K to go, thanks to some thunderstorms going on in the area. So while it is the Giro, it's not technically the fault of the Giro. It's more the weather that was going on at the time. And it looked like they did get rained on pretty hard at one point when there was still two riders up the road, including your teammate, Suzanne Anderson, in like an impeccable jersey, the Norwegian national champ jersey. So good.
First road race after winning it last weekend. And it's pretty cool to have that jersey in the team. It's a Norwegian team, so they were all really happy. But yeah, I was just following it on Twitter and I saw Susie was in the break, which I can see the thought behind that. It would have been good if there was a few more riders in the break, so she could have shared the workload a bit better. But yeah, it's a shame that she wasn't able to get over the climb before the main climbers were caught her. But there's not loads of stages like that in the Giro this year. There's not loads of opportunities for real GT battles and climbers to get out there and show what they can do. So I think it's pretty much was going to be like that just because they wanted to just make the most of it.
as you said yesterday, first pink jersey to be handed out after the stage was canceled yesterday. With that in mind and it being Van Vleuten's last season, it makes total sense that she would have gone after this climb the way that she did. And I think she followed a move by the two little Trek riders, Elisa Longoborghini and Gaia Riolini. Trek is coming into this race with a couple cards to play, and those two are definitely their top contenders for the general classification. But Van Vleuten ended up attacking the two of them, and it looks like Elisa actually got dropped from her teammate Gaia Riolini at one point because she was in a chasing group behind. And then we had Gaia Riolini and Marta Cavalli chasing down Van Vleuten, which was awesome to see if you're fans of Marta Cavalli and her, the last year that she's been through, to see her up there in the mix for the general classification was really great. And also I think like Gaia Riolini continues to be a super impressive rider at the moment, but also in the future.
Yeah, I was really happy to see Marta Cavalli up there in the Pointiana racing again. It's been a pretty hard year for her, and I know she's struggled a lot in the peloton this year. So yeah, I was happy to see that. But I think it's good, like Little Trek, they have a few cards to play, especially in a stage like this today, because they have the climbers, but they also have Lizzie, who knows she's there firstly as a teammate, but stages like today, she's can climb a little bit better than Lorena, or she can climb better than Lorena, and she can still sprint pretty well out of a group that's just got over a 7K climb. So yeah, they had a few cards to play. If it went hard on the climb, then they could have Borghini there and Gaia. But yeah, it's pretty cool.
Lizzie, like another awesome rider to see back in the peloton, out for different reasons than Marta Cavalli. But yeah, like just love seeing her back. I also feel like, look, everyone is really hating on the Little Trek kits, and I think they're not so bad. I think that they would have been better if the design on the back like wrapped all the way around the front. But I really just, you know, the hate out there on the internet is, there's a lot of it.
Oh, I actually quite like it. But I like it. I mean, we've just got so many just standard kits that are just like boring. So I think it's good for a kit to be that bright and colorful. And I mean, each to their own, I guess.
So in terms of the race, we had Van Vleuten go over the top of the climb first with a just over half a minute on Gaia Riolini and Marta Cavalli. And then behind them, just under a minute from Van Vleuten, was a group of chasers that included Longoborghini, Cecilia Trip-Ludwig, Juliet Labou. And we had Gaia Riolini and Cavalli eventually be reeled back in by that group of chasers on the descent. And Van Vleuten ended up winning by 45 seconds over that group, which is a pretty big margin if there's not much climbing to come in the rest of the race.
Yeah, it's pretty big. I'm not really sure where they can get that back from. It's hard to drop Van Vleuten on any climb. And she's pretty aero as well. I did look at the weather that they had today, and it was a headwind, but it was only 3 kilometers of wind. So yeah, that didn't really play a part in it. It was twisty as well. So generally, like when you're on your own doing a twisty descent to the finish, it is a little bit quicker because you can take the lines you want to take. But yeah, first pink jersey. It's strange to hand the pink jersey out on technically the second day of the race.
First pink jersey and 100th UCI victory.
That's pretty cool. And I mean, also she has got a good team around her. I mean, she hasn't always needed a team around her to defend the jersey, but she has got good teammates there now, like Flaucher, and just riders like that can just ride the front for kilometers after kilometer. So yeah.
So do you think the race is over then?
It's not over. I think it probably makes it a little bit more exciting because teams are going to have to come up with different ways to catch her out and beat her. So it's not over. Nothing's ever over until you cross that finish line for the final time. But yeah, it's going to make for an exciting race.
Speaking of exciting races and races being over early, SC Works had a shocker of a day. Not a single rider in that chasing group. Their first rider to finish was Niamh Fisher-Black, over 2 minutes, almost 3 minutes down, which is not something I think we would have expected from Niamh. She's won the best young rider classification at this race multiple times and was coming in as their leader with Demi Vollering waiting for the tour. So a pretty interesting situation for them to be in. I think at this point, there's a sprint stage coming up on stage three. It is actually going to be a sprint stage unless it's a breakaway day. But I think that with a rider like the Reina Wiebes in the peloton and with SC Works having really no skin in the game in the GC anymore, that they will turn their attention to bringing that, their surefire win to the line ahead of anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice for them to let other teams win. But I was expecting, I mean, Neve Fischer-Black, she's just come off a stage win at the final stage at Swiss. So I was a little bit surprised that she wasn't in that chasing group. Yeah, as well, I was a little bit surprised that Canyon Shram didn't have a rider in that chasing group either. They've got Soraya Paladin, Chloe, Paulina. So yeah, they've missed out a little bit there as well. I'm not quite sure how far down their best rider was, but yeah, maybe they can just turn the race around a bit and just go for stages, turn a disappointing first half of the race into a pretty great one in the final few days.
I guess that's like all the better for us because we at home get to watch more exciting racing with less teams in the fight for the general classification. Yeah, it actually turns out the news came out this morning that Chloe, when she crashed, she hit her hip pretty bad. They thought that she'd fractured her sacrum until about midnight when they determined it was just severe bruising and so she could continue racing. But severe bruising and racing a bike is not a combination that you would want. So it's unsurprising, I think, that she didn't finish in that chase group, that she finished well. She finished behind Neve Fischer-Black because we've seen Neve come across the line, so over 3 minutes down. Definitely a disappointing stage for Canyon Sram and for Chloe because she would have been for the overall. And also, I think she would have really wanted to test herself against a rider like Annemiek on a climb like this because she's not done a ton of climbing in the past, especially against the World Tour riders.
Yeah, I mean, I think Canyon Sram put a video up a couple of days ago and Beth was asking, the media manager was asking, how many Giros each of the riders have done. So you've got Tiffany there, who's done, this is her 13th, Soraya Paladin, it's her 10th. And then Chloe, it's her first. So she's never done a race this long, this many stages back to back. So it's a shame that she's started it like this, because I think it would have been really good for her to show that she can do it and to prove to herself that she can do those back to back really hard days. Luckily for her, tomorrow is it will be quite a relatively easy day. She can just hang in the peloton and maybe recover. But we don't know how bad it is. I mean, it must be pretty bad and uncomfortable for them to actually go to the hospital and get x-rays. So yeah, but I don't know if she's the kind of person and rider that will just go home.
No.
So yeah, see how it goes. But yeah, they'll be monitoring her quite a lot throughout the day and just seeing how she goes back end of the week. I mean, they have got that rest day, but that's a few days away still. So yeah, just have to look after herself.
Maybe one of the other just major takeaways from the day is that FDJ Suez has a lot of riders still within the conversation. They had three riders in that group with Avita Music, Cavalli, and Cecily Utrup-Ludwig, who finished second on the day. So they've not had a ton of luck this year so far, but good to see them with three riders up there, still hopefully in the hunt for some kind of move in the GC.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's a strong team to have three riders in the top 10 on the first stage. Yeah, they've come here with a strong team. So I'm excited to see what they can do.
Veronica Ewers was in that chasing group and was one of the riders that was working hard to try to bring Van Vleuten back. So let's hear from Veronica Ewers.
Just in the transfer to the stage three after stage two, felt like stage one today after a not so successful prologue yesterday. It was a somewhat chaotic day, just very flat, fast stage going into the main and only climb of the day. So a bit of tension in the peloton, but ultimately I think people were just ready to get going on the road racing. Annemiek did her thing and dropped the bomb toward the beginning of the climb with about seven, maybe 6.5K to go to the top, and managed to stay away Personally felt okay with the climb, and then, you know, had to give it a shot at the end with about 600 meters to go. Sort of an all or nothing attempt, maybe a bit futile or futile, but it was good in the end. And yeah, looking forward to helping our sprinter of the team tomorrow with the sprint stage.
All right. Well, Hannah, we'll be back tomorrow to talk about stage 3. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks again.
All right. It's time for us to wrap up here. What are we doing tomorrow?
Tour de France. Same thing we do every day.
Ah. Like going, Pinky in the Brain.
We're going to San Sebastian tomorrow.
Yeah. We finish in San Sebastian tomorrow.
I'm going to the airport.
No, Ronan's going home.
We have to drop you off mid-stage.
Mm-hmm.
That's sad. Drop me off
mid-stage. Yeah. It's going to start.
For me or for you?
Everyone.
Yeah.
And you're not coming back.
It's not that big a detour.
No, I just meant that you're leaving, not that we have to drop you off. That's fine. I'm sure we can factor that into our itinerary.
I thought I spoiled your celebration that I was leaving by informing you that you had to drop me off at the airport.
We're sad. We're sad Ronan's leaving, but you have more important things to attend to.
It's the first tour that I have left when I was supposed to leave. The past two tours, I was supposed to stay about 5 days, and I've ended up staying like 10 or 12.
We'll see what happens tomorrow. You already said once, you're like, oh, I'm supposed to be leaving tomorrow.
I mean, like, yeah, I would definitely stay, but I'm on a flight tomorrow. When I'm on the flight, we'll all believe it, but I believe it right now.
Yeah, you have more important things to do, and we will continue onwards without you, which will be sad, but we'll do it. All right, we'll be back tomorrow with stage 2 of the Tour de France. It's another lumpy day here in the Basque Country. It is not quite as difficult as today. I would expect a much larger group to come into the finish. But it's no joke. It's still a lot of climbing. And I think we could see a bit of action toward the end of the stage. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.